21 years. I don't know why it is in England that the 21st anniversary is celebrated with special nostalgia. I suppose it's because 21 years represents the age of discretion, the time in which a child grows up to become an adult. And it's certainly an awesome thought that this service now reaches that particular moment in its history. It has been a very extraordinary adventure for all of us who have been engaged for so long in broadcasting to the world, most of the time from the same point here in London. But what is even more awesome to me personally is the fact that some of the great moments that I have been involved in here in Bush House can actually be made to live again because they have been recorded and preserved. So let us start with one broadcast I was not involved in, the very first time the European service of the BBC was on the air.
Hier spricht London. Sie haben soeben eine Rede Mr. Neville Chamberlains, des Ministerpräsidenten von Großbritannien, gehört. Es folgen nun einige Nachrichten.
Qui parla Londra. Pochi minuti fa avete inteso le parole in inglese del signor Neville Chamberlain, il primo ministro della Gran Bretagna.
Ici Londres. Mes chers auditeurs, à 20h ce soir, Monsieur Chamberlain, Premier ministre de la Grande-Bretagne.
Yes, that was a montage of the opening announcements recorded during the first transmissions of the BBC's European service on the 27th of September 1938. Colleagues who were actually involved in them have told me how improvised and unplanned this first broadcast was. They were prominent journalists known to speak the three languages involved, and they were rung up at short notice and asked to come to Broadcasting House to translate a statement the then Prime Minister, Mr. Neville Chamberlain, was very anxious to bring to the notice of people in Germany and Italy. For those September days of 1938 were, of course, the time of the Munich crisis. Chamberlain had negotiated with Hitler, but he had a feeling that his motives and aims were being misrepresented in Germany. He knew that the German propaganda machine could keep the German people ignorant. And so he had asked the BBC to put his statement directly at the disposal of people in Germany, in Italy, and also in France. I think these improvised beginnings are very characteristic of the motives and spirit behind our work here. To this day, in many of the services broadcast to Europe, the idea that knowledge of the real motives and aims of this country would be a factor for peace still plays a very important part. Well, that hastily improvised broadcast in German, French, and Italian was the beginning of the European service. War was prevented in September 1938, but it came nevertheless in September 1939. And as the scope of the war spread, the European service grew. More and more languages were added to the original three, and very soon the voice of the BBC from London had become one of the most powerful influences in a Europe overrun by German forces. I remember those days very vividly. When I joined early in 1941, our offices were in a women's college somewhere in Regent's Park, whose pupils had moved out to the country. On the way to my office, I remember I used to pass a glass case with an enormous stuffed tiger. But the studios were already in Bush House, so much of our time was spent travelling across London. And then, one morning in May 1941, I arrived at my office and it had gone, a bomb had fallen nearby. From then on, we were all in Bush House. Space there was restricted, and life extremely chaotic. But it was a very exhilarating experience nevertheless, for here, assembled by the chances and vicissitudes of war, was a real microcosm of European intellectual life. Distinguished people from France, Italy, Belgium, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and all the other countries, and some of the best brains in this country, were working together in a spirit of real fraternity. I can't think of a better word. Some had happened to be in London at the time, and others had arrived during the retreat of their forces from the continent. Others again turned up by mysterious ways and means. Their private lives were completely disorganized, but anyhow, Most of them hardly had any private lives. In the crowded rooms and corridors in the basement, at first from a very small number of improvised studios, the voice of Britain and the voice of the occupied countries was going out strongly and steadily. I well remember the tall figure of General de Gaulle going down in the lift to make one of his memorable broadcasts, like this one of June 1940.
Or, beaucoup de Français n'acceptent pas la capitulation ni la servitude pour des raisons qui s'appellent l'honneur, le bon sens, l'intérêt supérieur de la patrie.
The case of de Gaulle is, I think, one of the most spectacular pieces of evidence for the role of broadcasting in the 20th century. For he is a leader who established himself mainly through his broadcasts. He became a live personality to millions of his compatriots over the heads of the occupying power. Of course, he could never have done this if he had not possessed the outstanding qualities of leadership that he did possess. But it was through broadcasting that he was able to create the symbol of de Gaulle, which played such an important part in the history of the war and is continuing to play it to this day in the history of France. And leaders who were already established also needed and made memorable use of the broadcasting medium. Voices like Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands.
En zeker niet minder verheugend is uw geestdrift voor het doel dat wij ons gesteld hebben, de overwinning.
Or of King Haakon of Norway.
No, jeg taler til dere I dag. Etter for derved å understreke at vi herude I våre tanker.
Or of President Benesch of Czechoslovakia.
Spoluobčané republiky. Ve chvíli, kdy reprezentant berlínského gangsterismu Reinhard Heydrich.
And of course there was always the voice of Winston Churchill, which went out in English in this service and in translations in all the other languages.
The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit upland. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
The announcers who read Churchill's speeches were always very proud to do so. I remember one of them who was always given Churchill's speeches in his own particular language. He would, without hesitation, come in, even during his holidays, to be the voice of Churchill for his listeners, a privilege not to be missed. Well, the presence of all these distinguished people and our role in putting their message across to occupied Europe merely emphasized the importance of our work and the enthusiasm with which it was carried out. I'm not looking back at this nostalgically as if to a golden period. The war with its bombs and anxieties was an unhappy enough time in all our lives, but because I think all this is still very relevant to our broadcasting today. The tradition of the European service, its spirit, were established then, and they are as strong today as in those times. I don't know whether you who are listening to me listened then, but if you did, I think you will agree that this is so. I certainly feel it very strongly. In the special combination of a sense of purpose with very firm principles as to what constitutes honest news and sober and impartial reporting. Of course, in the early days of the war, there was little else we could do but be sober and stoic in reporting bad news. Nevertheless, the way this was done was an object lesson to such a young apprentice in these arts as myself. I still remember a German prisoner of war, after the Allied forces had landed in France again, who told me about his impression of our broadcasts in those early days.
After Dunkirk, I became convinced that Hitler was bound to win, that however gallantly Britain carried on by herself, she had no chance. But then, one day, I listened to a news bulletin from the BBC. It opened with the news of the fall of Singapore. No attempt was made to hide the gravity and unexpectedness of the loss of one of the most important military bases of the British Empire. If anything, the gravity of the news was underlined. Knowing full well how our own propaganda would have tried to explain away or to belittle a similar loss, I was very much impressed. They must be very strong indeed to be able to be so frank, I said to myself. And from that day onwards, I was convinced that Hitler could not win the war.
But at the same time as being honest to the point of masochism, the team of the European service managed to combine this with a tremendous conviction of ultimate triumph. Of this, the V sign became the symbol. The use of this sign, based on the Morse sign for V, victory, was first suggested by a member of the BBC's Belgian team, Victor de Lavillet. In our English service to Europe, it was launched by a broadcaster using the pen name of Colonel Britton on July the 31st, 1941.
Now, here's a strange thing. There's a V sound. Morse is the universal language of telegraphy. Each letter is spelt out by means of dots and dashes. And here's the letter V, the sign of victory in Morse. Three short taps and a heavy one. I'll do it again. Have you got it? When you knock on the door, there's your knock. If you call a waiter in a restaurant, call him like this. Hey, garçon. Tell all your friends about it and teach them the V sound. If you and your friends are in a cafe and a German comes in, tap out the V sign altogether. Have you got it? Tap it out on the table with me. And now, here's something else. I've got a record here that I want to play you. Do you know what that is? It's the first few bars of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. Number 5, do you notice that? 5, the V again. Beethoven's V Symphony, his Victory and Freedom Symphony.
So successful was the V campaign, in so many places in Europe did the V sign suddenly appear, that Goebbels, knowing that he could not suppress the V sign, tried to confuse the issue by turning it into a symbol of German victory. But no one was deceived. Millions of Europeans looked to London and listened to London. Many of the BBC's commentators became famous throughout the countries they broadcast to. Men like Lindley Fraser, who now heads the German service of the BBC, and whose name became a household word in Germany during the war. Or like Colonel Stevens in the Italian service, with his endearing English accent in Italian.
Buonasera. Se Mussolini avesse capito gli eventi della guerra dopo il 10 giugno 1940.
Il colonnello Buonasera. That's how Colonel Stevens became famous throughout Italy. Nor did the BBC's European service neglect the weapon of satire and wit in its wartime broadcasting. When the Germans occupied Paris and made Radio Paris to carry their propaganda, the BBC's French service countered with a musical slogan.
Radio Paris Mont, Radio Paris Mont, Radio Paris est allemand. Radio Paris Mont, Radio Paris Mont, Radio Paris est allemand.
In German, a number of regular features exposed the Nazis to ridicule. Notable among these was Kurt and Willy, a weekly dialogue between a Nazi and an ordinary German.
Hallo, Kurt. Nam, Willy. Nimm Platz, bin gleich fertig.
Was machst denn da? Eine Landkarte? Du studierst wohl die Lage.
Jawohl, die Niederlage.
So ja, bunte Fähnchen.
In Italian, there was a similar satirical dialogue called Axis Conversations between a German and an Italian. The German was always suitably tactless in pointing to the minor role of Italy as Hitler's partner. And then there was the Osteria del Buonomore, a weekly dialogue between some racy and witty Italian folk characters.
Oh, ecco, io ho le carte, sette bello, tre scope, i denari, so sei punti,
Oh, oh, ambroglione, che denari, i denari sono i miei, no, è la primiera, e tre scope fanno cinque.
In those years of the war, the European service with the BBC was more than a mere instrument of communications. It had an important strategic role. Through it, the underground armies of Poland, France, and other European countries received their coded orders. Many listeners in Europe may still remember those mysterious messages they heard on the French service.
Pour Lucien, nous avons 17 arbres dans notre verger. Nous aurons 156 pommes cet été. L'escargot ne connaît pas la crise du logement. Le colonel porte une chemise rose.
In the Polish service, these code messages were conveyed by music. Almost daily, it had its minute of music, during which important information was passed to the underground army by tunes like this one. And then the time came when it was no longer necessary to speak in riddles. On the 6th of June 1944, it was over the European service that Europe heard the voice of the Allied Commander-in-Chief, General Eisenhower.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies.
The people of the occupied countries of Europe regarded the BBC's European service as their own radio. And this feeling found a most graphic expression in the Greek service. When the Germans had invaded Greece, the call sign of the Greek radio disappeared from the Athens wavelength and reappeared in the Greek transmissions from London. It is one of the most original interval signals in Europe, the sound of shepherds' pipes mingling with the bells of their flocks. After the liberation of Greece, the Director General of the BBC solemnly handed the call sign back to the Greek radio, and it returned to Radio Athens. When the war was over, not only the call sign of Athens radio was returned to the continent. Many of the distinguished men and women who had broadcast from London also returned home. And from being a weapon of war, the BBC became an instrument of peace. It was in London that the General Assembly of the United Nations gathered for the first time. And from London, the world heard the voice of Ernest Bevin, Britain's Foreign Secretary, outlining their post-war task.
Mr. President, I can give the utmost assurance that not only His Majesty's government, but the people of Great Britain give their wholehearted support to the United Nations. We will try to make the best contribution we can and use to the full every instrument which is created under its auspices. We will strive with all other governments to prevent another aggression and another war.
Those days were as stirring as the days of the war. Much of the radio system of Europe was suffering from the after effects of the war, and many people relied on us to keep them informed of the course of events. But, of course, it was also a sad time of starvation and destruction. I myself remember my first trip to the continent as a BBC correspondent. It was to Nuremberg, where the world, as it were, was searching for the causes of all this destruction, like a patient lying on a psychoanalyst's couch. And, of course, the Nuremberg trial was faithfully reported and broadcast from London. Here is a recording of the chairman of the tribunal, Lord Justice Lawrence, reading out the verdict to some of the defendants.
Defendant Hermann Wilhelm Göring, on the counts of the indictment on which you have been convicted, the International Military Tribunal sentences you to death by hanging. Defendant Rudolf Hess.
Gradually the world regained its normal face. And international broadcasting really came into its own. It would be wrong to say that the wartime years, exciting as they were the climax or the fulfillment of our work in this field. It is far more important to contribute to the less spectacular but much more vital task of slowly breaking down ideological barriers and the barriers of prejudice and ignorance between nations. This is what I, for one, really regard as the main purpose of our work here. Just as a great newspaper is not made by its special editions reporting some sensational event, but by a slow build-up of its standards and principles, which it transmits to its readers, and thereby raising their standards and principles. You, our listeners, are of course in a much better position to judge whether we are succeeding in this. But as far as I'm concerned, this is the aim of our work here. But let's return to our archives and listen to some of the highlights of our broadcasts in the post-war years. The first post-war Olympic Games were held in London, and the BBC not only broadcast every phase of this great sporting event to all four corners of the world, but also put its facilities at the disposal of broadcasters from many countries. Here's a recording of the opening ceremony.
We swear that we will take part in the Olympic Games in loyal competition.
Another important event of the first peacetime years was the creation of the Edinburgh Festival, which turned Edinburgh, that Athens of the North, into a place of pilgrimage for art lovers throughout the world. We have broadcast many notable performances from the festival. But the BBC's most extensive operation of the post-war era was the coverage of the coronation of Britain's young queen, Elizabeth II, in June 1953. Through the BBC's domestic and external sound services, and through television, Eurovision, and TV film, millions of people in all parts of the world witnessed the solemn and moving ritual of the dedication of a new sovereign to her high and responsible duties. Millions of people within and outside the Commonwealth, this memorable coronation broadcast became a lasting and living symbol of the spirit of Britain. And to further the cause of understanding between the nations, the BBC inaugurated a large-scale program of teaching English by radio, for English was fast becoming the main means of communication between the peoples of the world, a real world language. But, of course, as we all know, many of the hopes for a happier peacetime world were disappointed. The tension between East and West, already noticeable immediately after the war, grew, and international broadcasting felt the impact of the Cold War. Jamming became its symbol. The BBC's services to Russia and in some other languages have been jammed from about 1949 and are still being jammed today, in spite of the communist leadership's professed aim of reducing the tensions of the Cold War. In penetrating this curtain of jamming, the BBC's services in the languages of the people behind the Iron Curtain still perform an important task. For they keep people in these European countries aware of what is happening in the West and of what the West is really thinking. And in spite of jamming, the BBC's broadcasts are heard behind the Iron Curtain. How important they are became clear more than once in the last few years. For example, during the tense weeks after the Poznan riots in Poland, when that country shook off some of the worst features of Stalinism. And also, in a more tragic context, during the tense and dramatic days of the Hungarian Revolution. On the 4th of November 1956, the BBC recorded and retransmitted the tragic last message of the Hungarian Prime Minister, Imre Nagy, in which he told the world that Russian tanks had attacked his country.
Ez közlöm az ország népével és a világ közvéleményével.
As regards the allegation that the BBC's broadcasts had incited the Hungarians to revolt, let us quote one of the most treasured messages the BBC's European services have ever received in the first 21 years of their existence. It was a message sent to the BBC's Hungarian service from the Hungarian radio in its brief moment of freedom in 1956.
We express our appreciation of the London radio station of the BBC for the objective information given to the world about our people's struggle. We were particularly gratified to note that there was no incitement to extremism and that the tone of the broadcast expressed solidarity in our joy over victories and in our sorrow when weeping for our dead.
Well, that message made us very proud, but it also made us very sad. These 21 years have, in fact, been full of exciting, exhilarating, and also tragic moments. And the episode of the Hungarian Revolution showed us once more how difficult and how vital our task remains to provide a beacon of sober, reasonable information in a world so often plunged into the darkness and fog of misunderstanding. That was the motive which prompted a British Prime Minister 21 years ago to ask the BBC to broadcast to Europe. And to this day, we are pursuing the same difficult task.